I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Hoonie Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
An officer took an oath to serve and protect, and we didn't witness any level or expectancy of service and or protection.
As we talk about police brutality, it was going on when I was growing up. And so my parents told me, if you get locked up for something that we talked to you about, do not even make the phone call because we're not coming to get you. All my brothers and sisters were told that. They were serious.
Those are the voices of Chef Eric Williams and his father, Ricardo Isom, our guests on this special episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses
to make some sense of this.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. We have something a little different for you today, and it's something I'm frankly honored to be bringing you. If you have been listening to the pod for a while, then you know Chef Eric Williams. Eric is the chef and co-owner of Virtue Restaurant in Chicago, Illinois. He first guested here earlier this year, and the conversation is one of my favorite episodes of the show. More importantly, in some ways, Eric and I, who met for the first time at that interview, have become friends out of the morning we spent together recording the show back in November. Several weeks ago, in the wake of the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police, Eric asked me if I would host a conversation on this show between him and his father, Ricardo Isom, an educator, administrator, and also a pastor, about an unfortunate American tradition known as the talk. If you don't know, and this is discussed in more detail in the actual conversation, the talk is the phrase that describes the conversation that many black parents in the United States have with their children, in which they coach them in how to conduct themselves in interactions with the police to hopefully avoid things turning violent or deadly. I have to be honest, as a white guy, I was surprised and deeply honored that Eric came to me with this request. I was also more than a little daunted by the prospect of moderating this conversation. I've known about the talk for as long as I can remember, but I'm no expert about it, and I'm far from an expert on black life in the United States. But Eric's my friend, and when a friend asks you to do something like this, you say yes, and you trust that their faith in you is well placed. So I prepped as I would for any interview, and I hope I did them and the subject justice. I know that Eric and Mr. Isom did for sure. It took me a while to get this show posted. We had some technical issues during our remote sessions and had to break it up into a few sessions in slightly different locations. I've done my best to smooth out the audio, but if you have a sharp ear and notice any variance in background noise, that's the reason. The delay, of course, somewhat poetically, brought us to the week that Jacob Blake was shot in the back in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and the weekend we marked the anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, and Dr. King's historic I Have a Dream speech, as well, of course, as the birthday of the late Emmett Till, who was actually mentioned in this interview. And Emmett Till was, of course, the black teenager lynched in 1955. His killers were acquitted by an all-white jury. If you're wondering why Mr. Isom connects the story to whistling, it was alleged at the time that Emmett Till wolf-whistled at a white woman, leading amazingly to his murder. Other things were alleged, later admitted to be false. Not that any of it or anything justifies a lynching. The late John Lewis referred to Emmett Till as his George Floyd. And if you don't know the whole story, it's well worth your time to read up on it. Two quick personal notes. One is that this is one of two episodes we've been working on here on the pod related to the subject of race in America. The other, a collaboration with my colleague Scott Barton, and more directly connected to issues in the food industry, will air in the coming weeks. I hope you find them thoughtful and useful. Please share your feedback with us. I'd love to hear from you. Links to leave us a voicemail or email are at the bottom of our web pages at andrewtalkstochefs.com. blackvictimsnetwork.com. Also, I'd like to dedicate this conversation to all the Black victims of police brutality in the United States. And personally, and on a much more micro level, I'd like to dedicate it to the memory of a professor of mine. When I was a college sophomore in 1987, I took a class on African American literature with a wonderful, gentle, and brilliant man named Marcellus Blount. He was the first African American professor to teach literature at Columbia University, and was, I believe, in his first year in that role when I took that class. For more reasons than I can go into here, Professor Blount, the books we read by authors like Zora Neale Hurston, Ralph Ellison, James Baldwin, and someone who comes up in this interview, Frederick Douglass, as well as my fellow students, who included some of the very few Black students at Columbia at the time, were transformative for me, where my understanding of and ability to talk about issues of race were concerned. Professor Blount died much too young, but I think he'd have been proud of this particular collaboration. At least, I like to think he would have been. I'm going to present this conversation with no interruptions, so let's get right to it. Here is our talk about the talk with Chef Eric Williams and his father, Ricardo Isom. Here you go. Thank you both for joining us. Eric, thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this conversation with the two of you. I'm thrilled to have you here. I had two questions that I thought might be a good way to start this conversation. One is for you, Eric. You know, I can be a little slow on the uptake sometimes, and I might be wrong about this, but your name is spelled with a K. It's not the most unusual way of spelling Eric, but it's not the most common way of spelling Eric. And I was just wondering, you know, you quote on your website for Virtue Restaurant, Frederick Douglass, quote is, "Where there is no struggle, there is no progress." And my question for you is Eric an abbreviated version of Frederick?
No, the spelling of my name was not based on any references to Frederick Douglass. And you are the first person that's ever asked me that.
The other question, if it's not too personal, is I am struck that the two of you do not have the same last name. Mr. Isom, I'll throw it out to you. If you could just please break that down for us.
Eric's mother and I had Eric out of wedlock. And so that's why our names are not the same. That was the decision that was made in the family.
So is Williams his mother's last name? Or
yes.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for sharing that. I hope that wasn't too personal a question.
No, it's a legitimate question, and I can answer the K in Eric's name part.
Please.
The family referred to me as Ricky, and so that was as close to Ricky, R-I-C-K.
Got it.
Our birthdays are 4 days apart.
You know, I'll have set this up in the introduction, but, you know, this all started with Eric reaching out and saying that he wanted to have a conversation or have me help facilitate or moderate, I don't know what the right word is between father and son, but about, you know, the talk, quote unquote, the talk. And I guess what I'd love to ask is what each of your experiences with that unfortunate ritual in American life, you know, in getting ready to have this conversation, I did some research, or I tried to, and I admittedly, I, you know, at this time I can't go to a library. Spent quite a bit of time Googling it every which way I could. I read several articles. Nobody really that I could find, although I'm sure it's out there in some scholarly work. I don't know when this notion of the talk, this talk that, you know, Black parents give their children in this country about how to interact with the police. I don't know how far back that talk goes, when it really started to become such a given in American life. And I guess, Mr. Isom, I'd love to start with you. Was the talk as a rite of passage, was that something that was given to you when you were a young man?
What was given to me was how to deal with people, or how to respond to people in positions of authority. That, of course, incorporates the police. But how to deal with people in positions of authority, dealing with racial tensions being different when I was growing up. But if there's an adult in authority and they're talking to you, there is a proper way to respond. There's a way to respond to minimize any type of
So that was specifically with an eye on the racial component and not just, you know, the typical thing that most parents or most responsible parents try to teach their kids of you know, be respectful of your elders and that kind of thing. This was specifically with an eye toward a predominantly white society and how to sort of move through it without too many incidents or problems.
Yes, because as we talk about police brutality, it was going on when I was growing up.
Sure.
And so my parents told me, if you get locked up for something that we talked to you about, do not even make the phone call because we're not coming to get you. All my brothers and sisters were told that. They were serious. My youngest brother was at Loyola University and actually got locked up. And my mother called me and told me, and I said, well, we're going to get him. She said, you know what I told you? I said, times have changed. People suddenly are found dead in police lockups. I said, we have to go get him. She said, then you go get him. So they were just as serious, and he was in his 20s that they were when we were all young kids.
Now, was that because he had done something objectively wrong or bad in their eyes, or that he had not heeded the advice about how to speak to people in a position of authority? In other words, was there an actual transgression there? I'm not asking for specifics, but was it an actual transgression, or do they think he had sort of acted unwisely in the situation?
They were adamant not to put ourselves in a position where we were compromised so that somebody could beat us, somebody could lock us up. They were adamant about that. They would take up the fight if it was going to be injustice. But we cannot put ourselves in a compromised position and then expect them to bail us out.
Eric, what about, I mean, it's funny to ask you this with your father right here on the line, but did your dad give you the talk, and what are your recollections of it, if so?
So no, my father never gave me the talk. However, the conversations that we had spoke to decency, and they spoke to this idea that there was a standard of respect and a standard as it related to managing myself, managing my affairs, and managing my interactions with other people. And so the standard wasn't the police. The standard was every single person that I had an interaction with.
So is the implication of that, that because of that, you were, I guess, indirectly or more globally kind of equipped to respond a certain way in situations that people were referring to when they did give the quote unquote the talk?
I guess the best way for me to answer this is, you know, many of the conversations that my family had were in-depth conversations, and not to discount any conversation that a parent would have with their child as it relates to their safety. The conversations that were had with me dealt with safety overall, and it wasn't just safety as it related to an officer or a specific instance. As we all know, right, the world is dangerous. And you know, I remember my family talking to me in depth about a very simple concept. And I remember it because it's a saying. And the saying was, if you can't pay for anything in life, you better be able to pay attention. There was this trained awareness to what was going on around me, what body language meant, and I'm still sensitive to those things to this day.
Yeah, this actually reminds me of the first conversation we had. I don't know if you'll remember saying it to me, because I'm sure you've said it in a lot of conversations over the course of your life, but we talked about the neighborhood where you grew up and how it kind of, in a lot of ways, prepared you for a kitchen because it honed certain instincts, made you very aware of your surroundings. This is all of a piece with that, yeah?
Yes, but some of what was trained at home and what I gathered just living in the community had overlap, but they weren't necessarily trained the same way. So it's two different spaces of information.
You know, living in a big city, I mean, I grew up in Miami, Florida. I've been in New York I can't do the math offhand, I'll just say since 1985. You both are lifelong Chicagoans. You know, it's been very striking to me since this, I guess what we would call a watershed moment, or what seems like maybe a watershed moment, the killing of Mr. George Floyd, you know, I have been really struck at the number of people who seem to all of a sudden have kind of become alive to what life is like you know, for Black Americans, even in big cities, you know, one of the reasons I've always felt so attracted to, for me, New York, but I've also always loved, you know, Chicago. I love Los Angeles, Philadelphia, where my father and my grandmother were from, is that I feel like they felt to me places where people were much more real, where there was more sensitivity to this, where you can't really kind of live in a bubble. Everyone's kind of thrown together. And I have to say, I now look back and I feel like I've been very naive because I've seen so many people seemingly become aware of a lot of these issues for the very first time. I guess I'll start with you, Mr. Assam. I'm wondering if your experience of this moment has been similar to that, or if this has been completely unsurprising to you. My guess is it's the latter. And also just what this extended moment in the wake of the Floyd killing, what it's been like for you to be living through it.
You're right. The latter would be correct. The idea that people have become more socially conscious, the idea that people begin to take a look at some things that they probably had looked at but didn't see it at the same level. I think what happened now is a cause and effect. The cause of the pandemic, it caused people to be isolated and be at home. And then the Floyd incident caused people to not just be in the business of what they're always in the business of doing, but it caused them to have some conversations with somebody. And the more conversations they had, and the more things they saw on television that they thought was unfathomable, it brought people to a sense of awareness that had been lost. And this goes now across culture and across generation.
And what's it been like for you to see this moment unfolding? Does it create, let me just put it out there just that broadly. What are the things that have come up for you having lived the life you've lived up to this point, you know, as a Black man in the United States? What's this moment been like for you to witness?
For me, it's a case of I'm glad somebody else has decided to get involved. I've been involved all my life, so I don't see myself in the sense of a Black man. I see myself as a citizen in the country that I was born in. And the things about my rights, my privileges, I have never acquiesced on. And so hide behind nationalism has never worked for me, and I don't entertain those conversations. Because if you don't understand your citizenship, then I don't know how you understand all these other things. It's similar to when a person takes a job. Don't tell me about what somebody's not doing. Do you know your own job description? Do you know what you're supposed to do? If you know that, everything else takes its own form and has a place. If I understand my citizenship and what I'm entitled to, what I should have, what I could have, then there's a process to go about it. And this excuse that the system, that white people, that the man and all that is doing to me becomes a series of pathetic excuses. Get up and do something about it as a citizen. And if it comes up that somebody's holding you back because you're Black, there's a way to address that. Whatever course you have to take, and I'm talking about, that's what the courts are for. That's what a number of things are for.
Right. Human resource departments, the courts.
Right.
Yeah.
See, I'm not going to let somebody else's limitation about me affect the fact that I'm not stepping forward to do what I should do. Their limitations are based on whatever social contract that they grew up in, when they grew up, where they grew up. But that's not my limitation. That's their limitation. I have some rights. And I have some things I'm supposed to be privileged to. So then I need to exercise those.
Generationally, this is such a fascinating thing to talk about. Was this something that was ingrained into you by your own parents, this conviction with which you're expressing this right now? Was this something that you came to over the course of your own maturation process? What was your relationship with your own parents like in terms of talking about this, in terms of this sort of unwillingness to accept what's been for way too long a status quo?
My parents grew up in the South.
Whereabouts?
Tennessee and Mississippi. And they were able to exercise their citizenship to the extent that they could in the South. So they didn't relinquish it when they came to the North. So when you talk about the South and talk about the North, in terms of what you're talking about, the Jim Crow South
is only institutionalized when you come to the North. You have to deal with it both ways. You have to know how to deal with it. And so that was the conversation. I knew nothing until one day, so I was taught how to be a young man to grow into a man. That's what I was taught at home. How to respect people. I'm not better than anybody, and nobody's better than me. That was the mantra of growing up. I was whistling in the house one day, and my great-grandmother told me to stop whistling. I didn't know why I had to stop whistling. That's when the conversation about Emmett Till comes up. I was told, message sent, message received. But there was very few conversations that were isolated about something from a historical perspective of what had happened to Black people. It was always in the context of something bigger. And so I had to learn how to be a young man and be a man, but I could never humiliate and embarrass my family. That was personal to them. They were going to help me fight the fight that I needed to fight if I was right. But if I'm wrong, I'm standing out there by myself.
I just have to say, before I shift over to Eric for a second, when you said the comment that you're glad that other people are getting involved, I have to say, in reading about the talk specifically in preparation for this conversation today, I've known that phrase for a very long time. It's always been something that's very upsetting to me that's a fact of life for Black people in this country. I did find two essays, and I'm sure there are many others out there. The gist of both of them, they're both written by Black authors. One is Autumn McDonald. The other is Angela Searcy. I hope I'm pronouncing her last name right. Searcy. And this is very interesting to me because, and I have to say, it's again, when I say that I think I've been very naive in my approach, this is what she writes. White parents need to start having the talk with their children. White allyship can no longer be confined to retweet sad faces on Facebook or thoughts and prayers. When white parents talk to their kids about racism, they shouldn't just frame it as an abstract concept divorced from lived reality. And then she goes on to say, racism is a virus. If you're not actively involved vaccinating your children against it, it will infect their hearts and spread. Angela Searcy wrote, the talk should not just be one talk, but a series of open-ended conversations throughout a child's life, and not only Black families should have them. And I have to say, I've traditionally taken the standpoint of, I try to take every relationship on a case-by-case basis. I treat everyone equally, and I've kind of shut out people in my life who have horrible attitudes about these things. And I realize for myself, this is my own little small modification recently, is that that has not obviously been enough. Everybody does need to engage this fight. You hear about things like the Civil Rights Act, which are so, more than half a century in the rearview mirror at this point. They're taught as progress, and they were progress, but obviously the struggle is still very much uphill on a day-to-day basis. I was struck to find two essays, again, by Black authors saying that, there needs to be a version of this conversation that all parents have. Eric, what for you has this moment been like, this new moment of reckoning, this moment of seeming engagement by a new group of people onto this cause?
I'll pick up where you left off, and then I'll talk about this reckoning. I think it's important to state, because you started the conversation with me, making reference to Frederick Douglass. And you were correct in citing the fact that we admire his oratory and his literature. And part of his literary work that happens to be expressed on our website is where there is no struggle, there's no progress. That particular piece speaks specifically to embracing challenge, embracing struggle, and in an effort to embracing freedom. What has to happen in our country, not today, not yesterday, but continually, is this deep empathy for humanity. It can't be about Black people. There can't be a conversation as Americans that happened in one home and not in another home, as if we don't bleed the same. As if the hearts of a white parent feel different than the hearts of a Black parent when they're mourning the loss of their child, or mourning or frustrated or in fear because of the abuse of their child. I don't know a parent worth their salt that does not feel deep anguish when there's a threat to their immediate family, especially in the case where it is someone that they've given life and or birth to. And so there has to be a sensitivity to life as it relates to humans. What we've seen over the past 10 years or 15 years is this increased awareness to the life and the safety of animals. If our pets are held at the highest regard, then what does that say about us as a people when we look at how we treat each other? Secondly, I would say, I don't think I got a chance to thank you for hosting this opportunity for us to have this discussion. And I think I should add a little bit of color because it's in line with the reckoning. I've had the opportunity to speak to many people over the past several weeks, some looking to be absolved, some looking for validation, many of them looking to get direction from someone that they trust. And there's been a lot of dialogue around this idea that all of a sudden, every white person with a black friend has picked up the phone and either apologized and or asked for some directive. And I've been very fortunate because that hasn't happened to me. What has happened to me is I have friends that happen to be really decent. They happen to be very informed. They happen to be very passionate people, and they are legitimately friends. And so the difference in that phone call has been as such. If I had a plumbing job to do at my home, I would likely call a plumber if I chose to take that job on myself. I wouldn't go in as a novice and try to tackle a job that I had no real information and or data on and hope that I could figure it out along the way. Most of us understand that both fire and or water are clear ways to destroy a home and a whole lot of other things for that matter. And so with something as sensitive as issues that relate to race, it wasn't bizarre to me that people call me because of the amount of respect that's shared between the people that I share discourse with on a day-to-day, week-to-week, and month-to-month basis. That being stated, my emotions were raw, they were very real, and they were very rapid. And I don't think I've ever had a moment in my life where I've had such a rush of emotions and had need to process them as rapidly as I needed to process them. And so what I did at some point is stop answering the phone. I stopped talking to just about everyone outside of my house. And I did what works for me. And that was, I took a lot of moments to meditate. And meditation as it relates to me is prayer, because I needed to reset and I needed to recenter. And then after I prayed, I took a moment to think about who was in this situation before me and had to address it head on. And so I found myself reading passages that Martin Luther King Jr. wrote about rioting, about protests, and what his feelings were. And I don't tend to take other people's thoughts and clone them. And so from that space, I began to allow that information to inform my thoughts and inform my current situation. And I really sifted through a lot of information, and not just messages by King. I read a lot of Frederick Douglass's speeches as well. That allowed me to take some information that I felt was given during a very hostile period of time, similar to what I felt like I was going through, and process that at my pace. And as I did that, then I began to share from that space
with a different sense of urgency that I think was needed at the time.
I think the word you used was anger. You were talking about having so much, such a swirl of emotion around this moment that you needed to sort of take a break. And then you took some time to meditate and to pray. I'm wondering, when you refer to that, which stage of this of this incident are you referring to? And the reason I asked the question, and not that all of them haven't been horrible, but it's not like the murder of Mr. Floyd was the first atrocity along these lines that any of us have seen. So I'm actually wondering if you're referring to the incident itself, to the kind of spectacle of, I guess, allyship or whatever we would call it that happened in its wake, or a lot of pent up feelings that it suddenly felt okay to air, or none of the above?
I think I'd like to outline first that anger wasn't the only emotion I was dealing with. I was extremely angry. There was a level of fear. There was this moment of confusion. There were moments of extreme concern about a multitude of things. My awareness was extremely heightened, which brings about a different level of sensitivity. I wish I could speak to one thing I was angry about, but there were multiple things. I live in a community that was dramatically affected by all the actions that were taking place surrounding George Floyd's murder. As we witnessed the business corridors go from people peacefully protesting to being looted, I quickly recognized that, you know, once people looted whatever they could loot from those corridors, at some point they'd have to come back home. There was a part of my brain that was frustrated by the ideal that the neighborhoods could be destroyed in a way that left these neighborhoods even more barren than they currently are. There was also a level of anger and frustration around the fact that businesses that were beginning to get targeted were businesses that profited in these same communities. We see faces of African Americans on commercials, but we see very few resources as it relates to the kind of things you would expect to be in place and or position in communities. And I mean things as simple as Little League teams and sponsorship for those t-shirts, junior bowling leagues, chess clubs, and things that are opportunities in other communities that aren't readily accessible in many of the under-resourced African-American communities. That's before you get into food deserts and access to health care. I mean, very simple means of developmental skills and forms of entertainment in these neighborhoods that draw bridges between businesses, business ownership, and everyday patrons. I was also frustrated because I felt like, to some degree, this happened on my watch. Many Americans have seen these injustices take place over and over and over and over again. And for whatever reason, and I'm sure there are many reasons if we polled people to find out why they didn't think their voice would be heard, why they didn't feel the need to adequately do research about what steps they could take to improve our current conditions. And I say our with a lot of emphasis, because this wasn't a black problem. This wasn't a brown problem. This wasn't an indigenous people's problem. This was an American problem. And it is an American problem. We like to argue in favor of how great our country is. We like to argue in favor of the men and women who have lost their lives fighting for our freedoms. But I don't hear enough arguments around this ideal that our forefathers wrote a declaration that speaks to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I witnessed someone lose their life because someone overused their power. And I didn't see a whole lot of liberty in that instance. All I saw was 8 minutes and 46 seconds of intense oppression and an abuse of power. The interesting thing when we talk about the matter that triggered everyone, because we had limited access to health care before George Floyd lost his life. We've had neighborhoods that haven't been rebuilt in communities for the last 30 to 45 years. We've had food deserts in and around our city for at least the last 15 years, if not the last 20. All of these things were already in place. But the one thing that triggered us was this injustice that was described as an officer taking on, charging someone, judging someone, and then commuting a death sentence in public, right? It was a public execution. What really stirred me is this idea, you know, people were like, well, you're not honoring George Floyd's death by doing X. You know, he was a criminal, or he was a this, he was a that. You know, the list of reasons why somebody should get a public execution were as long as anyone's arm. But the one argument we didn't have is this idea that an officer took an oath to serve and protect, and we didn't witness any level or expectancy of service and or protection. Because to have his hands in his pocket was a clear statement to everyone that he wasn't threatened. And that's enough to make anybody mad that's thinking.
I think it goes back, Eric, and tell me if you disagree, but, you know, as you were just going through all this, you know, two things that really struck me, that just jumped out at me. You mentioned the oath, right, that police officers take. At some point, we're seeing this with a lot of things that are happening, you know, around the country right now. We're seeing this in Portland, you know, with federal troops on the ground, you know, against the wishes of the local mayor. At some point, all these things boil down to individuals and groups actually acting on these oaths and these traditions. You know, the oath did not prevent the atrocity on the part of that police officer, nor did, you know, this notion of the talk. And I don't know if Mr. Floyd's parents ever gave him the talk. But, you know, the talk didn't get it done either. You know, one of the things that was so, to me, horrifying, and anyone who's watched that 8 minute plus video can hear it will probably be able to hear it forever, is that, you know, all the way to the end, he was saying, please, sir, you know, and part of the talk, as I understand it, as I've read about it, you know, there are these things that I've seen in multiple articles about it, you know, pull over right away, keep your hands on the wheel, don't make any moves or reach for anything without getting permission first. And one of them is this notion that you act extremely politely, you know, say, sir, yes, sir, no, sir. Neither end of that equation managed to head off that horrible situation and its horrible outcome. I mean, it does sort of make you question how the value of something like an oath, you know, or even the value in any possible isolated incident of the talk. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense to me, and you're correct. As we witness that, we should question the value of an oath. We should question the value of our current system for training police officers. But more importantly, we should question, when is enough enough? When are the bad apples going to be treated as such? That officer is not a reflection of every single officer that's on the police force.
Right.
My heart went out to decent men and decent women who had to hold a line peacefully when they're outnumbered and armed. Because the reality is, when you're armed and someone approaches you, you're at high alert. And you have to, in that moment, maintain the highest standard possible because your life is at stake. And the person, the aggressor, right, may not be trying to take your life, but you can't tell what their motives are. And this isn't an opportunity for me to side with police and disagree with citizens. It's an opportunity for me to talk about this idea that we can't look at this from one side. It should be a disgrace to every single person that wears a badge when one person breaches the line of injustice. Many media groups covered, and they covered it well, the looting. Many people had thoughts, many people responded in outrage. Folk in their communities who felt like they were going to have less access to basic needs, people outside of those communities who couldn't understand why people would loot in their own communities. But the one thing I didn't hear people speaking about in outrage was this idea. Many of those people were looting because they recognized that the police had stood down. There was an opportunity, and some people weren't out there because they were mad. Some people weren't out there because they wanted to get something back from the man. Some people were out there because they were opportunists and they were taking advantage of this opportunity to have free goods, stolen goods, someone else's goods. Describe it any way you want. We get angry about the effect, but we weren't angry about the cause. And if we were angry about it, Lord knows I didn't hear it nearly as much as I would have liked to have heard it. And the cause was we had an officer abuse power for the same reason that people were running in windows, because he didn't believe there was going to be any recourse. And it's been proven that officers break the law and then judges let them go. We have a better chance of convicting someone who ran in a shoe store on those days than we do consistently convicting officers who break the law. And I don't know why I'm calling them officers, because they're not officers. They're criminals.
You know, it's hard for me. Well, it's hard for me to say anything better than you just said it. But, you know, in some of the larger societal, I guess, pieces of what you were just talking about, and I guess I'll throw this over to you, Mr. Isom, for a first response. But, you know, it seems to me that a lot of, I'm trying to think how to categorize the different constituencies here, right? Let's say people whose heart is in the right place, maybe. I think there's just this terrible, as I think about it over most of my adult life, but as I think about it in the context of the last few months, I think there's a tremendous failure of empathy. I mean, this is really, to me, what I'm constantly struck by is this seeming inability by a lot of people to imagine themselves in someone else's shoes, in the shoes of somebody from a different background, in the shoes of someone who's experiencing life in a very different way. I mean, there's proof all around us. There are books to be read of all kinds. But to me, I just feel like, and I don't know, maybe because I'm a writer, it's kind of part of the job description is to try to understand, you know, people you write about, which tends to just bleed over into how you deal with people in life generally, or maybe vice versa. But Mr. Isom, I'd love your response to that. Do you agree with that? I feel like there's just an absolute, I just put it that broadly. I think it's a failure of empathy of people you can never really know what life is like for somebody else, but to really try to go through that thought exercise and that emotional exercise, I feel like what I've become aware of is that that's just something a lot of people, I don't know, just aren't necessarily equipped to do, almost at a metabolic level.
I will attempt to answer that. We've had a few paradigm shifts in our society. One, everybody understands what used to be the golden, what is the golden rule? Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. The shift was those with the gold rule. That's one shift. And it took a lot of people with it. So forget about how you treat somebody. If I've got the gold, I do what I want to do. Another problem, huge problem, with the many, many temples, synagogues, and churches in this country. What are you talking about on Sunday or Saturday or Sabbath in general? As if we're on another planet. What's happening in our country? Oh, that's over there. How many times did we hear on the news? I didn't think that could happen in my neighborhood. Things happen everywhere. So we have people who have found ways to escape what is the real problem, and they isolate themselves and insulate themselves in a different way of thinking. And so when it's a problem, it's their problem. Unless it knocks on my door, it's not my problem. That's why so many people have problems with the pandemic. I'm not supposed to get sick. I go to the fitness club. I have superior health insurance. How could I get sick? Crises and trouble and things happening are coming to everybody. But if you rationalize the fact that it can't happen to me, or it happened to what Eric just said. What happened to George Floyd is because of his background. No, that's apples and oranges conversation. They wouldn't read his B of I sheet when they had his knee on his neck. They wouldn't read anything about his background. And if, in fact, that he did pass a counterfeit bill, it doesn't warrant that being the outcome. But the other problem is, when did somebody give license to law enforcement to be judge, jury, and executioner? That is not part of any social contract, and it's a social contract in America that's broken.
We've been speaking on a very personal level. I'd love to ask each of you how you are given professional disciplines. And I don't even know if professional applies necessarily, Mr. Isom, to one of yours. But, you know, how they inform your outlook on this, any kind of takes you may have on this dynamic that we're talking about. Eric, I'll start with you. You know, as a chef and a restaurateur, as someone who has a real cross-section of humanity in normal times anyway, you know, paraded before you on a given night of a vast range of interactions. Does your experience in your profession inform your attitudes or your outlook or your, I guess, forecast, either optimistically or pessimistically on any of these things we're talking about?
I think everything we do informs us. And everything we hear informs us, as well as the things that we see, even when we don't want them to. Many times you hear the statement, it's not like I can unhear that or unsee that. So I would definitely say yes, both the conditions that are happening in the world and the conditions that we create in virtue inform my decisions. Each day informs the next day. And I work very, very hard not to allow my life to be a continuum of bad decisions, negative circumstances, and challenging relationships. So I work diligently to make sure that there is a line, that there are boundaries, and that there is a measure. And I do that through a constant reassessment of my days. I, as I develop young people in this space, there is an accurate accounting from day to day on what happened. Things that we deem as great and things that we deem as failures and things that we believe we need to work on. And I do that for myself. And I liken it to the process that we actively see in sports. And when we think about our greatest stars or people who strive for excellence, these days we just call them GOATs, the greatest of all time. They all attest to this moment where they review tape. They study the opposition. They study their own movement and how people respond to that movement. And so, like those athletes, I'm beyond my prime and have no aspirations to be a professional athlete. But I do have an aspiration to be a professional every day that I show up to work and to embody what professional means on in every sense of the word. And so, though I don't take an oath, to serve and protect, it's part of what we do. We protect the space that we're in. We spend a lot of time and energy making sure that our team feels safe and that we create measures that allow that safety. We want people to come into this place and feel renewed, being part of what restaurant is for people, to be able to show up to a space and hit reset. And sometimes it's a hard reset. If we think about
what our response is to just being hungry. And we all joke about this notion of being hangry, right? And hangry usually renders you to a space that you are so hungry, no matter how much food you eat and how delicious it is hardly as satisfying as it would be had you eaten before you gotten to that point, because you're at a point of extreme.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt, but I don't know if everybody knows this, but the origin of that word, hangry, is the mashup of hungry and angry. I don't know if everyone knows that, but that is, I believe, what that originally connoted.
Agreed. And so with that being said, we're in times where people are anxious, where people are afraid, where people are seeking validation from places that maybe we shouldn't even seek validation, where we're crave for human interaction. And, you know, I'm not a fortune teller. I don't coin myself as a prophet, but I will tell you, we couldn't have opened a restaurant that was named Virtue and embodied this idea of high moral standard that pivots on hospitality and kindness at a better time. And it's not as if people didn't need space that was kind and hospitable 5 or 8 years ago, but we really need it right now. We take our job serious. We take our profession serious, and I take my approach to my day serious, and that I'm in care of. The topic is not really talked about in this sense, but I'll jump in with both feet here. We watched two people change history. I don't believe what George Floyd did warranted the outcome. But I don't know how many more African Americans needed to be harmed before the world woke up. At one point, we had 7 continents protesting in some form. And I've never witnessed anything as mobilized and as passionate in my entire lifetime. In closure, yes. My interactions with people, my interactions in this space, and my interactions in the world at large inform how I'm responding.
You know, Mr. Isom, I'm struck, you know, and I think it's a fascinating combination of, I apologize, I don't know what the appropriate word would be to refer to the fact that you're a pastor. I don't know if vocation, calling, I'm not sure what the right noun to apply to it is, but the fact that you are that, and the fact that you have studied science, biology, and that you until you moved up into into the role you play now, that you were actually a classroom teacher of science. I'm really curious to know how those two disciplines, I mean, in my mind, I imagine they're kind of duking it out in some way. You know, the empirical evidence is not very good as to where we're headed, but, you know, but most religions do teach things like, you know, forgiveness, grace, a certain, faith in a very broad sense. I'm just wondering if you could speak to how those two parts of your life affect your outlook on all of this.
Both require of themselves an approach that has to be consistent and has to be one of commitment. And the approach has to be you working for posterity's sake. You cannot stand before children and not prepare them for their future. All these other things and all these other things people argue about, you're preparing someone's child for their future. And the parent was the first teacher. So my job is not to mess it up, but continue the work that needs to be done to prepare them for the future that they would live in. A future I may not see them in. In the church, what are you preparing people for? Same thing, posterity. Now, across the different faith and orders and whatnot. There are different things that people believe. But if you're not preparing them for a spiritual sense of salvation for eternity's sake, then what are you preparing them for? Anybody can get some music and dance. Anybody can be entertained. But there are things that people have to deal with. How do you best deal with them that helps you deal with it today, tomorrow, and whenever after tomorrow comes? So if there's a simple phrase that says, know the truth and the truth shall set you free, do I even know it? So if I'm not free, then maybe I don't know the truth. And what is it? No, it's not your truth, my truth. It's not norms we set in a meeting, speak your truth. No, truth is absolute. If you believe in a high being, if you believe in the creator, then truth has to be absolute. But am I even looking for it? That becomes the other question. Or am I just, have I settled for less, or am I just satisfied with whatever the status quo is? In informal debate, they take the approach that there's an inerrancy somewhere, there's a harm, because you start with a resolution. But then what is your solvency plan? What plan do you have to make this better? Most people don't have a plan. People argue all the time about the harm or the inerrancy, maybe not the same way, maybe separately, but they have no plan. So you just want to be mad, and you just want to vent, and you want to beat your chest. And at the end of the day, what changed? Absolutely nothing. And it's not going to change tomorrow and any other day until you come up with a plan to make it better. You don't like the status quo, then come up with a plan, a solvency plan to make it better. Don't sit in my car in the backseat and tell me how to drive. You want to drive? Sit in the front seat, grab the wheel, brake and accelerator, and drive. And probably because of the way you act, I'm not going to ride with you because I don't believe you can drive. You just talk. I like what Eric said. Day-to-day informs us. I want my best self today. Can I be a better self tomorrow? Not by what somebody else is not. What am I today and what am I going to be tomorrow? You want change? Be the change you want to see. That's a Gandhi quote. Enough people don't want to be any change. They don't want to be change agents. They happen to be agents provocateurs and agents saboteurs because they wreck everything. But they don't want to be change agents because it takes consistency and commitment. And it takes working for something other than yourself.
You know, it is interesting to me. I'm sure I must have said this to you, Eric, at some point in one of the chats we've had recently. But, you know, I do believe that it wasn't just a matter of the Floyd incident being, you know, quote unquote, the last straw, because if that's all we needed, that would have come a long time ago. I do believe that this moment we're seeing in this movement, if it does prove itself to be that ultimately, was made possible by the pandemic, by the fact that people were at home, by the fact that people who, you know, might have just seen that as one of many stories in the news were actually at home sort of marinating in it for days and then weeks and not able to just turn back to their busy lives. And, you know, I mean, for me, I do hope that to both of your points that as things hopefully start to ease back into normal, you know, Eric, I know you're serving people again in your restaurant, for example. You know, I do hope that people will not forget the feeling that they had when they were kind of forced to be with that horrible incident in a real way, and then start thinking about a lot of these other things in a real way. You know, I've been kind of moderating or driving the questions here. Eric, you were the one who proposed that we have this conversation. Is there something you'd like to ask your dad? Is there something you'd like to say? You could ask me something if you wanted. I don't know what it would be, but it doesn't have to be anything, but if I just give you the floor for a minute, is there anything you'd like to toss out there?
A couple of things that I would toss out. I would toss out something that my father taught me, and it relates to your culture, which is a shared culture. And it is the statement that has been made by the Jewish community for many years in this country, to never forget. The day that we forget the atrocities of our past is the day that we start to create room for them to reproduce and be reinforced. And so as you speak about this perfect storm, so to speak, for a movement, a person is abused, which ends to murder, ends with murder. The whole world sits with it, and many people respond. I think there's an important factor to flush out here. The whole world was sitting with something else before we even got to George Floyd. We had to relinquish power. It didn't matter how much money you had. You had to rethink your first class ticket. It didn't matter how poor you were. You had to rethink your summer plans. And so things that we were accustomed to doing and possibly were entitled to do, because entitlement has been a huge part of the debate. And we recognize that some folk, based on the color of their skin, based on what side of the tracks they grew up on, have been entitled to resources, privileges, access that some others have not. But we've all had entitlement to something that we've taken for granted. And there was a reckoning in homes all over the world, not just in America, as it related to the access that we had just a few weeks before COVID hit our homeland or our home. And so now you're sitting with this shelter in place, or as some people stated, sitting in this moment of being grounded. And what the movement allowed people to do is to actively be a part of something that was bigger than themselves.
Mr. Isom, anything that's come to mind as others have been speaking that you might want to share or add to the conversation?
One of the things I talked about some long time ago was that this was something I talked about in church, and it's about time. And so our language, where it's a beautiful language, is not as descriptive of some things as they are in other languages. So in the Greek language, time is defined as discussed as chronos, in a manner of how we keep time, chronographs, punch clocks, all that. That's chronos. Kairos is also time, but it's a life-changing experience at a moment in time. And so there have been so many people have had this life-changing experience in a particular moment due to the economic downturn, due to COVID, due to the protests against racial injustice. Somewhere across those three things, people have had a life-changing experience. And it's happened to a lot of people. And it had nothing to do with where they live, when they were born, who they knew and who they didn't know. It happened. And because it has happened, people are not going to go back to how it was. Because when they decided to do something after the life-changing experience, they decided to do it. And it wasn't just something to do because I don't have anything else to do. They had to make a commitment that I'm going to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. And that's a wonderful thing for people. And it's a place we used to be as a society, a place we lost, and it's a place we have now come back to. There's more work to be done, of course. But the fact that more people have gotten to that point to even want to have a discussion like we're having is a wonderful thing.
Well, I'm not even asking Eric if he has anything else to add to that, because that, to me, is the perfect way to end this conversation. You know, in my mind, I was thinking of saying something like, well, you know, we're not going to solve all these problems today. I don't know what people expected from this conversation, but I think that's a beautiful sentiment to end it on. Eric, are you okay with that?
I'm totally okay with it.
And also, I have to say, Eric, you know, you've somewhere in the middle of this conversation, you thanked me for hosting. I told you this the other day offline. I'm sure any podcast around, certainly anyone in the food space, would have, you know, been thrilled to have this conversation. I was flattered. I was honored that you brought it to me. I hope it was what you wanted it to be. Anytime you want to come on and pick it up, either yourself or both of you, open invitation.
Thank you so much. I'd like to say one thing in brief. I deemed it important for us to have shared space and shared dialogue as a result of the many questions that were posed. My father has informed a lot of my thinking, as many parents have informed how their children think, and not because children are a clone of their parents, but because it's your first witness to how another human deals with struggle and deals with success and deals with life in real time. And the problem is, in our society right now, is so many people are disconnected from a familial space that we look for information outside of the ones that are closest to us. And I am honored that people trust me enough to ask the kind of candid questions that they ask. And I thought the best way to represent a path, not to give people a bunch of answers, but a path to solution, was to be an example of what that path looked like. And so I, again, am grateful that you gave us this opportunity. I'm grateful that my father heeded the call. And I hope that this discussion can help folk that are in our community, you know, rightfully named the hospitality community, and anyone else that may be impacted by those folk as they take care of the great many people that we assist, feed, raise money for on a day-to-day basis.
And that's our show for today. Again, my great thanks to Ricardo Isom, with whom I plan to dine at Virtue one of these days when it's safe to travel again. And to my friend, Eric Williams. Thanks to After School Special for our music. Please seek out their album, Double Barrel, Single Entendre, on iTunes. As always, if you are able to at this tough time, please consider supporting the show with a monthly contribution via our Patreon page. That's Patreon, patreon.com/AndrewTalksToChefs. You can also support us cost-free with a review on Apple Podcasts, a social media post, or just by telling a friend you think might enjoy the show about the pod. Thank you for listening, and we will see you back here soon with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.